This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
But I asked my dad a few times, and he said, up until 85, 86, they thought that this would never end, that this would go on for even our lives. Maybe it would be a bit better and things would get better, but socialism and the Soviet Union, it's so strong and it's so big that there's no way that anyone can or anything can bring it down.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Balint grew up in Hungary, right next to the border with Austria. Part of his family escaped in 1956 and went to Australia, and Balint's grandfather survived 4 years in a gulag camp. Would you like a Cold War Conversations coaster? It's easy. Just sign up to Patreon, and for the price of a couple of coffees a month, you'll be helping to cover the show's increasing costs and keep us on the air. Plus, you get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster too. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. So, back to today's episode. Balint's home village was a hotspot for escapes. Being so close to the border, the locals knew the area well and helped many people across for money. He tells the story of his father, who used to play right next to the fence with his friends, often messing with the border guards. They could see tractors on the opposite side in Austria working in the fields. One quick note before we start, Balint now lives in Ireland, hence the strong Irish accent you will hear in the recording. I'm delighted to welcome Balint to our Cold War conversation. Living close to the border, and also, you know, living in Hungary in early 80s, what sort of family stories are there that you can share?
Just about life in that region. By the 80s, it was not nowhere near as strict as it used to be, like in the 70s or even further back in the 60s. So obviously the system was crumbling, and they probably couldn't afford to have the border protection they used to have. But there was still, I remember going to my grandmother's village, and as we left the city, often on a bicycle going to Torun, I remember the guard post outside the village. They used to ID people going into that region, even up as late as 89, when the whole thing ended. So that was interesting. And obviously, as a kid, I didn't really understand why we had to stop and pull out the IDs, you know, going to visit my grandmother. But that was just part of life over there. As a kid, you don't really notice anything weird about the system, because that's where you grow up and that's what's normal for you. But there was things obviously that stood out a bit. This was one of them, you know, why we always had to stop. And obviously the fact that Austria was so close, we did get the chance to travel across the border quite a bit, while people from the other side of the country, not much. They had to obviously drive 450 kilometers to get to the Austrian border. So we were the privileged ones, and we had been a very long time up until 89, because 70s and the 80s, people from my region, they did get the chance to work there illegally and legally too. So there was always a bit more money in my region, and people were a bit more well off than than the other side of the country. And my family benefited from that too, because we did have relations in the West, and that it was much easier to keep in touch with them from our region than it would have been from, you know, the eastern corner of Hungary.
You told me earlier about a family story about your grandfather being brought to the police station.
Yeah, that side of the family, my dad's parents lived in a place called Buchu. Buchu is a tiny village, literally at the border. So Buchu was the gate to the West, and that's where my grandparents lived until the late 60s. And my grandfather told me a story that one day he was out in the back garden picking potatoes, and a guard passed a few times, and then eventually the guard went up to him and brought him up to the police station, and he was questioned. They found it suspicious that he was so close to the border for so long, and what he was doing there and all that. Eventually he cleared himself, admitting that he was picking potatoes, so the guard let him go because he was picking potatoes. So, but it goes to show you the mindset of the drivers or the guards. Everybody and everything was suspicious, and the whole village was so close to the border that was literally sealed off from the rest of the country, and was very, very difficult to get in there.
And when would that have been? Would that have been the 1950s or 60s?
This would have been the late 50s,
So after the uprising, when?
After the uprising, After the uprising, obviously in 56, a lot of people left Hungary. I think it was close to 300,000 people in a week fled the country. So the borders were tightened, and they even put down landmines and all that. So they tried to stop people going across, and it did work. But obviously the locals, according to my grandfather and my dad as well, the locals knew exactly where the mines were and where to walk across. Now, obviously, helping people and bringing people across was very dangerous because you could have ended up in prison for years. But people occasionally did help others, strangers coming and trying to escape. And Buchi was an absolute hotspot for escapees.
Right. So the guards would have been even more suspicious of anybody around because they knew it
very
was
much
a,
so.
It was an escape area. I mean, your grandfather sounds like an incredible character because you'd mentioned to me that he'd fought in World War II as well.
He wasn't much of a fighter. He was involved. He was there. He was at the Ukrainian front. He was with the medics, so he never fired a gun, and he was very proud of that. He was only 18 years old at the time, and he spent close to 5 years in the Hungarian army. And then when he came back, he joined our district hospital, and he worked there for 52 years.
Right, and I think you said he walked all the way back from the Ukraine.
Yes, he escaped from captivity, and he made his way home walking with, I think he was carrying a shovel or something, pretending to be working on the fields. And then when a group of soldiers, so anyone came, he just started picking the ground. And then that's how he made his way home.
Unbelievable. So that was your dad's father, wasn't it? And
yes.
Your mother's father had certainly a less fortunate time in Hungary.
Yeah, my grandfather on my mother's side was, he owned a little ice cream shop, and when he came back from the war, he had his own business, and in the Soviet system, that was straight away a bad thing, that business owners were picked out straight away. The business was taken off him, and he started working for a government establishment. And shortly after, he was gathered up with all the local men his age, and he was shipped off to a gulag camp. Somewhere we don't know the exact location. He never actually revealed the exact location, but he was somewhere near the Ural Mountains.
Wow, that's some way. And I think you said that he never sort of revealed what his experiences were like.
Yeah, he passed away in 1979, so I actually never got to meet him. But according to my parents and my grandmother, he very seldom mentioned what happened to him. I know he had an accident and he fell into a mine shaft, and he got pneumonia there too. He lied in there for a couple of days or overnight, or I can't remember the exact story, but I know he picked up a bad pneumonia after that, and then he was taken to like the Gulag hospital, and then eventually 3.5 years later he was released by miracle.
Right. Wow. So just coming back to your life, what age did you start school?
I started school at 6 in 1985.
Okay. And what was schooling like in Hungary in 1985?
I have very fond memories of school. I think the big difference is to today's kids and us in 1985, that we were real kids and we enjoyed our childhood. And I think we grew up slower than kids grow up today. And we had a lot of things to do, a lot of summer camps and a lot of weekend activities. And it was all free. And I can honestly say that the education system and the school system was fantastic.
Right. And was there much ideological influence in that you recognized at the time?
Do you know, I listened to a lot of your shows and a lot of people from East Berlin and the former Soviet Union and Poland. And it was nothing like that in Hungary. We got very little of that. I think Hungarian communism wasn't as hardcore as it might have been in other parts of the Eastern Bloc. We got some Soviet propaganda and obviously had to learn about the Red Army's glorious victories, but it was never too much. It was never too much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Hungary really sort of kicked off that 1989 year of revolution in Eastern Europe with the new government coming in and, you know, the opening of the border. So I think, yeah, when you're sort of period of growing up was certainly whilst Hungary was becoming more liberalized.
Yes, certainly.
And what was your favorite subject at school?
I loved geography.
Why was that?
We had a good teacher, and I remember he used to tell us stories about traveling the Trans-Siberian Railway. And I was just fascinated by those places and countries. And I used to love looking at the map and looking up places with weird names and faraway places. And I actually went on to study geography in college and I became a geography teacher. I never actually went on teaching, but I am a qualified geography teacher.
Right, right. I always love to hear those stories where people are inspired by their teacher to go and take a certain path. It's always a nice story.
Mm.
And, you know, as a child, what were your favorite books or TV shows or songs?
There was a lot of Hungarian kids shows at the time, all government made and all financed by probably some Hungarian, you know, socialist youth propaganda movement. It was all the same story. It was always like a naughty kid in the neighborhood who turned out to be good. It's all fit into that ideology, but obviously as a kid, we didn't realize that. We just we watched these kids stars at the time, and I loved that. And I also loved Knight Rider. Only thing with Knight Rider was that we could only watch that on the Austrian station. And I remember we had a black and white TV, and I didn't know what color the car was. I just guessed that it was black. It was in German as well, so I couldn't really understand. I have a bit of German, and I had a bit of German as a kid too, but I couldn't really understand it fully. And I remember one of the neighbor's kids told me the car was red. And on the black and white TV, you'd nearly believe it. It's hard to tell the difference between red and black. And for years, I was 100% sure that the car in Knight Rider was red.
That's a great story. So you tuned into Austrian TV for programs which didn't contain sort of communist indoctrination, by the sound of it.
Yes, and we recorded movies too, because the likes of Rambo and them movies were completely banned in Hungary at the time. So we had a video recorder, the VHS tape recorder, and we used to record everything from Austrian television.
Right. And how easy was it to get hold of a VHS recorder?
It was almost impossible to get in Hungary, or if you found a shop selling it, it was crazy expensive. So we had to make our way across the border and buy one in Austria.
Okay, so unlike in East Germany, you could cross the border into, well, what I term is democratic Austria.
Yes.
And that was an easy thing to do, was it?
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It was not easy up until 1984, 1985. Then there was two types of passports in Hungary. There was a passport issued for socialist countries only, and then it was a world traveler passport too. It's actually a different color as well. And I remember when my dad got the world traveler passport, and I was fascinated by it. And then in 1986, the government realized that it was no longer possible or needed to keep the people locked in, so they just issued the world travel passport for everybody. So that's where we started making regular trips across the border with our Trabi.
Right. Oh, so you had a Trabi.
Yeah, everybody had a Trabi at the time.
Okay. So Hungary didn't have any domestically produced cars?
No. We had Skodas and Trabants and all the rest from the eastern countries.
Right. And when you were in Austria, would they accept Hungarian currency?
No. That's another interesting story. When the government lifted the ban on the World Traveler passport, they also introduced a new thing. I looked it up recently. It was in 1986 when they allowed people to bring 200 Austrian shilling worth of currency with them. It was quite a bit of money. It would be the equivalent of maybe a couple of hundred pounds, or maybe more, maybe 300 pounds in today's money. Everybody over 18. So what every single Hungarian family did at the time, that with the Trabants, the two parents up front, the kids in the back, and the grandmother in the middle, in the back of the car. So the grandmother counted as obviously an adult as well, so she could bring her a couple of hundred shillings too. And that's altogether the 600 shillings, and you might have a bit of money hidden in the kid's pocket too, and you could buy a lot of things with that.
Right. Incredible. And now, what did you think of Austria? Did you notice a distinct difference when you crossed the border in?
Oh, absolutely. The second we crossed into Austria, everything was clean. Everything was organized. The grass was cut nice and neat. The shops were beautiful. Every shop had the automatic door. When you step up the door and it opens up, none of the shops had that in Hungary. A lot of different types of chocolates. As a kid, I could stand there and just look at all the different flavors for hours.
Yeah. So presumably you really look forward to those trips.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And how often was that? Was that once a month that would happen?
Yeah, probably once a month. And then definitely when there was a bank holiday in Hungary, then the entire city of Szombathely would go to Oberwart. Oberwart is the nearest sort of town in Austria. It would be maybe 30,000-35,000 people. So it's quite a big place, and people would cross over to do the regular shopping. The items would be, back in those days, bananas, coffee, chocolate, and then all the household items, kettles and televisions and
VHS recorders.
VHS, exactly.
Wow. So, I mean, presumably, you know, you were a member of the Young Pioneers as well.
I was. Very proud member, yes.
Right. So you had the scarf and everything.
I had the scarf. I had a red scarf. I had a whistle. I still have it. A belt with a nice logo on it. My blue pants and my white shirt.
Right. Right. And being a member of the Young Pioneers, what did that involve?
At the time, very little, because I joined in 1989, April. That was almost the end of the school year. And the winds of change were hitting the school as well. And people knew it wouldn't last too long. So I remember one particular time we went playing hide and seek with our group. But that's pretty much it. We didn't do much. To be honest with you, there was very little organized activities by the pioneer or the pioneer movement.
Right, right. So you managed to get the uniform, and then it all sort of started.
Yeah, and that was it, pretty much.
Right, right. Well, still, that's pretty cool. Being a member of the Young Pioneers, I guess.
Exactly. I still have my ID card.
Fantastic. I think you sent me a photo of that, actually.
Yeah, I did.
And you mentioned earlier you had relatives in the West. What could you tell me about them?
My mom's aunt escaped Hungary in 1956 with her family. She crossed over to Austria after the October Revolution. Her husband was involved some anti-socialist activities, and he was arrested and released and arrested and released. So eventually he decided to leave. He left on his own. Then he paid someone off to bring the wife and the kids over too. So they went across the border in late October, early November 1956. They stayed in Austria for a couple of years in a refugee camp, and they were shipped out to Australia.
Wow. Wow. And did they ever come and visit you in Hungary?
Yes. They first came in 1968, already as Australian citizens. A few interesting stories there too, how the authorities handled them.
Well, we like an interesting story, Balint, on this.
I know they had to check into the local police station every single day.
Wow. That must have been quite restrictive anyway.
Yeah, he was, and they always tell me how insanely cheap it was to come to Hungary. They said one day's wage equaled unlimited food in a restaurant for the whole family.
Yeah, yeah. And were they allowed near the border area, or did you have to meet them away from the border area?
With the people visiting the border area, you, as an Australian citizen, they were, because they were from the West. But with other visitors, let's say if you have a cousin coming from the other side of the country, they had to apply for the permission, and you had to send out an official invitation letter and get it stamped at the police station, and then give it to the relative, and then he could go and visit you in the village. But with them, it wasn't an issue because they were Australian citizens, so they were allowed to do a bit more than your average Hungarian citizen.
Right, right. Okay. And, I mean, we spoke a little bit earlier about life near the border, and you told me about these, that people who lived in the area needed a special ID.
Yes.
What knowledge do you have of escapes in that area? Because you did sort of mention it was quite a hot spot in terms of people trying to get across the border.
It was really. Buchi was quite a hot spot. So at the time, obviously after the 56 revolution, people saw that how bad communism was and how evil it could be. And despite the minefields and the heavy security, people did go across. And it was always with the help of the locals. There was normally that one guy in the village that would take people across. And then when he was arrested, then someone else would take over. But obviously for people coming to the area, they had to have the border ID. So they couldn't use public transport, or they couldn't drive a car. They had to make their way through the forests and the fields at night to hide in the bushes, and then go into the village and then look for that person, and hoping that they run into someone that would help them.
Right, Right. And were these people Hungarians or were they from other Warsaw Pact countries?
Hungarians, mostly Hungarians. I actually, when I visited the Iron Curtain Museum, and the guy that runs the show there told us a few escape stories. I asked the question if there was anyone ever trying to escape from Austria into Hungary, and everybody burst out laughing. And I was like, no, I'm serious. Any attempts from the West to come into? Is a good question. He says, yes. He says, Soviet soldiers coming back from Germany as late as the early 50s.
Right. Soviet soldiers who...
who were in captivity and then were released, and they stayed a couple of years, and then they missed a family and they tried to make their way home to the Soviet Union. Little they knew they'd be sent to the Gulag straight away, but they did try.
Yeah. Wow, that's it. That's interesting.
Yes. But mainly, obviously, the vast majority of these escapes were from Hungary to Austria. And I've heard a lot of interesting and sometimes funny stories too.
Go on.
There was one particular one. There was this guy from the other side of the country, and he made his way across the country. He made his way to Buchu, and then he found someone helpful and nice to him, and he explained that he wanted to go across to Austria, and he was really nervous and very scared. So the locals told him, okay, listen, you need to calm down a small bit because you're going to give yourself away too easily. So they gave him a little alcohol to loosen him up, and they said, okay, listen, all you have to do is just go a straight line, go across the forest, and then as you go over the hill, the other side of the hill is Austria. As you go over, you see the lights, and you just go into the first pub and then tell them you escaped, and they take you to the police station and they register you. And you can speak Hungarian because it used to be Hungary. That part of Austria was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So a lot of people across the border speak Hungarian. And I said, don't be afraid, just go there, tell him you escaped. So he took a bit more alcohol, and then off he went, zigzagging in the forest, eventually got back to the same village, went into the pub, and he told somebody he escaped, and he was arrested on the spot.
Wow. That's quite a sad story.
That was one of the unlucky ones.
And, I mean, the border at this point was barbed wire fences, so the locals knew where you could get under the fence or where there were gaps.
Yes, the locals knew. Even the kids knew. My dad used to work for a local farmer mining cows in the early 60s, like 62, 63, over the summer. And he said that they'd be there watching the cows in the field. And then they see the soldier, the border guard, going up to the tree, taking the key out of the tree back, open the gate. That was the electric fence, and that was like a normal, the double fence. So he'd open one of the fences, go in there, go for a walk, come back, put the key back in the tree back, and then off he goes again. So the kids knew exactly the key was in the tree back. All you have to do is go there, take the key out, open the gate, and you're free to go. But I often ask my dad, and why didn't you go? I would have gone. You should have gone. And then my dad used to say, look, at the time, as kids, we were taught at school that all these people that crossed the border, the criminals, they're letting their country down, and then they did something wrong, and then they have to escape. And then they believed this.
What about the border guards? Was there any instant? There must have been instances of the border guards deciding.
There was one particular story I heard. It's in my dad's book as well. He mentioned this story that was there was a guy, a tractor driver who came once a week to plow the field. It was nicely done between the two fences, so you can see the footprints. So he'd go over that and nicely smoothen it, flatten it out, and on with his tractor, and there would be a guard standing behind him, watching him, so he won't just drive the tractor into the fence and knock it over and go across. And one time when he was going on the strip, the soldier told him to stop because he had to go and answer nature's call. So the guard stepped away, and then he jumped on top of the tractor, jumped the fence, started running. And obviously, the soldier was told to shoot. That's they had to shoot. He didn't shoot because they were friends. They used to do this every single week, so together. So he went after him, and he escaped too.
Right. So they both went over. Wow.
Yeah, because he would have been arrested and prosecuted and put in prison, and he didn't want to do that. So he escaped. I heard another story. My dad went to school with this guy. He was a couple of years older than my dad. And they were already in secondary school. So it would have been maybe 65, 66, mid-60s. He was told by his mother that if you fail your exam, son, don't bother coming home because you'll be in trouble. So he took that so serious that he went back to the village, filled his shirt with apples, and went up to the tree back, took the key out, opened the gate, walked across, came back from America in the mid-80s. So there was a lot of people that from there, not so much from Butchu, but from, you know, it was such a small village that a few people escaped, but by the 60s, 70s, it was getting less and less.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the security was getting stronger.
Yeah, and then things were getting better in Hungary too. There was no real need to, people weren't living in this threatening, vicious dictatorship. It was a lot weaker than it must have been in Poland or East Germany. So people had quite a bit of freedom in those villages, especially in the villages. So they were quite happy.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's really interesting. So in the early 80s, were you aware of, you know, let's say not what not to say outside of your family circle?
Yeah, obviously there was things. Then one particular story that we had to learn Russian at the time, and we started that at the age of 7 or 8. And I remember my dad told me, "Oh, it's such a silly thing. They should be teaching you German or English, not this silly language. Like you'll never use it." And I told the teacher, and my dad was brought into the school. But there was no trouble about it. Nothing. They said, "Look, you shouldn't be saying things to the kid." But there was no police involvement or anything like that. But that was the only time when I said something I shouldn't have. But other than that, as I said to you before, it was in Hungary, it wasn't that strict. People were brave enough to speak out and voice their opinions. There was no Stasi looking over everybody's apartment. There was nothing like that in Hungary.
Yeah, yeah. I guess if your dad had said something like that 20 years earlier,
oh yeah, that would have been a completely different story. Yeah, and my dad told me that this all the factories in Hungary at the time and the Eastern Bloc were connected with other factories. So you'd have like a sister factory somewhere else, and every now and then you'd do a trip across and maybe the Soviet Union or Bulgaria, Romania, and then do like a gathering, mainly drinking, and quite often, this particular factory would get people from the Soviet Union or East Germany or Lithuania, Latvia, those regions mainly. And my dad said that they'd sit down and they talk away to them. And then it was incredible how cautious they were, like how scared they were to talk about the system. And the Hungarians would say, "Oh, what do you think of this silly, stupid system? And, you know, it would be so much nicer living in Austria and Germany." And they were just sitting there thinking, "Oh my God, what is he saying?" He could see the scared faces and the concerned faces, but there was nothing like that in Hungary. We had a lot of freedom to compare to other countries.
Yeah. No, that again, that's really interesting because I think some people don't realize the contrast between some of the different Warsaw Pact countries.
Yeah.
Hungary, the more I read about it, you know, it was obviously going to be the prime country to sort of try and get out of that Soviet sphere of influence because it had become more liberalized. And it's interesting you saying how the standard of living improved, so to the point at which, you know, less people wanted to leave.
Yeah, you know, we had very little, but everybody had that same little. Everybody had that Trabant car and the two-bedroom apartment and the holiday by Lake Balaton. And that was enough. Nobody was jealous. Everybody was sort of equal. And people were happy.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia. And I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Yeah, yeah. And when, I mean, you would have been very young at the time, so this might, you might not be able to answer this, but when did you become aware of the political situation changing? I guess it must have been around about Young Pioneers time.
It would have been. Like, I actually asked my dad, because obviously, as you said, I was very young at the time, so I couldn't really fully understand what was going on. I know that my parents never talked about politics up until 87, 88, when it started and there was problems. And then that's where the country's economic situation was, that, you know, the free education and the free healthcare, and that was taking its toll. And I wouldn't say, you know, we were struggling, but certainly we felt that the times were getting tougher. And then I remember my mom crying a couple of times and thinking, what are we going to do? But I asked my dad a few times, and he said, up until 85, 86, they thought that this would never end, that this would go on for even our lives. And maybe it would be a bit better and things would get better, but socialism and the Soviet Union, it's so strong and it's so big that there's no way that anyone can or anything can bring it down. So up until the late 80s, I think people were just sort of accepting the situation and knowing, okay, this is what it is and there's not much we can do.
Yeah, yeah. And in 89, did you start to see more East Germans in the border area because of the possibilities of the border being opened?
Yeah, but that was when things were already, the wheels were moving and the wheels were turning. I remember when these Germans came and they left all the cars behind. That's all I remember as a kid, the empty cars on the side of the road. That's the sort of image I have in my head, that the empty Trabants and whatever cars they had, mainly Trabants, packed up. And I know the Pan-European picnic, that thing. I knew the phrase, but I didn't have the foggiest idea what it meant, but I always found it sort of cool to say it, and I heard it on TV the whole time. And Chernobyl was another thing. I used to hear the word Chernobyl, and I was so, oh, it's just a nice sounding word, but I didn't understand what it was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the 9th of November 1989 probably wouldn't have been a big day for Hungary. Can you remember, you know, hearing about the fact that East Germany had opened its borders?
I knew that the Germans were led across. I saw that on TV, and I saw the happy faces and people running across. And I do remember watching that on the news. But I was 10 years old, so I didn't really understand up later on in my life. Obviously, I did. But at the time, I didn't really understand what was going on. But I just found it interesting that why they're running, why they're so happy, you know. But obviously, I understood later how significant it was in bringing down the whole system. And I'm actually very happy that Hungary was involved in it. And then Hungary probably put the last coffin in communism's, or last nail in communism's coffin, I mean.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're right. I think it was the first domino that, you know, set off all the other ones. And what changes did you see in Hungary as you got older?
You know, it's interesting because everybody I talk to, think Western people, like my friends here in Ireland or other people I talk to from Western countries, that they think it happened overnight. So like on a Monday morning, we went to school and it was completely different. It wasn't nothing like that. Like, things didn't really change until probably 92, 93. So it pretty much the same system and the same ideology. Like we even had to keep studying Russian. Even that didn't stop. And it carried on. You can't just stop something and then and just wipe it off the board and say, you know, millions of people's lives at stake, and you have to think before you. Obviously, the biggest problem in Hungary was the massive unemployment after the regime fell, because, you know, communism's fundamental idea is to that everybody has to be employed. No matter what, like even if there's nothing to do in the factory, you still have to go to work and you still have to be there, and technically you're employed. There's no unemployment whatsoever, and all these big corporations and American and English and German corporations bought off the Hungarian factories, and they realized, okay, why do you have 14,000 people working here? I only need 2,500. So suddenly people started losing their jobs, and my parents did too, and suddenly it was over 2 million people unemployed. But that happened slowly. So it happened it reached its peak by, I think, late 92, when it was over 2 million people unemployed.
Right. And how did your parents cope with unemployment?
My parents were lucky. My dad landed a job almost immediately. He because he was involved in adult education, the local job center took him on. So he probably unemployed for a week. So he went on and carried on with his work, and then he stayed in journalism as a freelancer.
Right, right. And it must have been, I mean, yeah, as you've heard from my other episodes, you know, the situation in East Germany was similar, but I think more sudden, with the currency union with West Germany, and then, you know, the big German companies moving in. But obviously, yes, that unemployment and uncertainty.
See, with Germany, I know what you're saying. I think there was one main difference in Germany. They got a lot of money and a lot of help from the West. Nobody helped Hungary, and there was no money coming in from anywhere. So Hungary was left on its own. Mm. And that's what my dad always highlights, that concern, that sort of a fear, almost like you were longing for the old days. And even when the last Soviet soldier left the country, I think they didn't leave until 92, the Red Army. It wasn't like people rolling the streets with champagne and jumping up and down. It was more like a depressed thing for adults, thinking, okay, who's going to protect us now?
Yeah,
who's going to help us if the Soviet Union was always there? It was there when you had to blame somebody. It was there when you needed help, and it was always there. It was just there, and then suddenly there was nobody there, and nobody cared about Hungary. And people were very scared and very concerned about the future.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a perspective that people don't really think about. I think people are often fearful of change, but this was fundamental change in the way the country worked and whether you worked, whether you had a job or not. So it's really interesting hearing that perspective.
It is really, and I think people living in the East always have this dream about, you know, living in the West and being free and enjoying freedom. But when you're given that freedom, it's another story. Then, you know, you sort of don't appreciate it, and you don't know what to do with it, because I'm free now and you're free. And do you really enjoy? I mean, you know, it's not like every single morning you wake up and you're like, oh yes, I'm free. I'm in the free world. After a while, it becomes your everyday thing, and you just don't care. And I think looking out your 9-story apartment block in Szombathely, looking across Austria, seeing those lights, and thinking, oh, you know, I'd love to be there. I'd love to live there. It was so cool to drive a Toyota, not a Trabant. But you know, when you actually get that Toyota, and when you live there, it's not much different.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting the perspective you gave about the, you know, the economy getting better and people not leaving and being content with a Trabant job, healthcare, you know, that side of things. And I think, you know, I've heard this said before about, you know, freedom. You can be free to travel the world, but if you haven't got a job and you haven't got the money,
exactly,
it doesn't really count for much.
Exactly.
What are your fondest memories of Hungary during the communist period?
Everything that in my childhood was just so nice and so good to remember. The holidays at Lake Balaton, my dad used to get 10 days every year through his factory job, and all the other factory workers and their kids. It was all the same generation, so there would be hundreds of kids my age, and everything was free or cost very, very little. I just enjoyed being involved in every school activity and hanging around with the local kids. We were a generation called the Keyers. I don't know if you ever heard the phrase.
No.
The Keyers kids. That was every kid had a key around their neck because the parents were working during the summer, so the kids would be at home in the apartment blocks, and so the mother would put the key on a little piece of rope and put it around your neck so you don't lose it. So we are the Keyers kids. That's how our generation was called. And it was all people born in the late 70s, early 80s. And every apartment block had somebody that was into fish tanks or you name it. Like every apartment had something else to offer. So we used to go to visit each other all the time. And there was a real camaraderie between the parents, is where there was always this guy that could fix your car, or that guy that could come and fix your coffee table, and people did help each other, and there was a real sense of camaraderie in those days, and that's what I sort of miss these days.
Can understand that. And what would you say are your worst memories of that period?
I didn't really have any as I was very young, but thinking back, obviously what happened to my grandfather would be definitely top of my list. It shows the evil side of communism and how bad it could be, and it shouldn't have happened, and it shouldn't happen to anyone. And obviously that, you know, you can enjoy, as a kid, you can enjoy a lot of things, but when you look at the bigger picture, then you realize that how evil and how bad it was. There's one thing that I always notice when I talk to people from the West, and look, I'm not a fan of communism or that system at all, but I always said if I was an adult at the time, I would have been the first one to escape. But there's a lot of things that we did enjoy, and it wasn't all just evil and bad. And when people from the West talk to me and tell me things, and I always argue my case that no, it wasn't that bad at all. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't all that evil. It wasn't like, you know, just shooting at people on the street, or there's certain things that were much, much better than now. And that's what I always want to tell, that they don't just see it as an evil system. There was a lot of good in it too.
Yeah, and I think you've described that well with, you know, that you describe in the community spirit that there was then, and you're also describing a safer environment. I mean, there's not many places now, parents now, that would let their kids out with just a key around their neck.
Exactly. But, you know, that had a lot to do with, there was very little crime. It was a police state. The police had power. You respected a police officer. There was no way you would have talked back to a police officer because you would have got a slap across the face. That did happen. I saw that happening, especially at football games. When I was a kid, I used to go to soccer with my dad every single weekend. And but people had more respect for the law and for each other too. But definitely. That's another thing.
Yeah, and I think that's probably true in the West, certainly sort of 50s, 60s period. There would have been a respect for the law. And I think it's also interesting, you know, you're saying that, you know, whilst it was a police state of sorts, there's a lot of similarities, you know, people can hear about their childhood and growing up in the descriptions that you've given there albeit you're right next to a barbed wire fence, you know, that is the border between Hungary and another country. But
yeah,
there's lots of similarities there.
You know, us kids growing up, we were really privileged in that area, because I remember Austria had flea markets in the 80s, and all the people from somewhere they would go to the flea markets, and you could pick up a mountain bike or a BMX bike or a skateboard for the equivalent of maybe £5 or £6, that today's money, so for nothing. The Austrians gave them away for nothing, but for us, to get a BMX bike from the West, everybody had one.
Yeah.
Because it was so cheap, but nobody, as you were getting further from the Austria border into Hungary, nobody had it. So I remember relatives visiting us from the Midlands and coming over and saying, oh my God, where did you get this bike? So it was a big thing for him, but it was nothing for us. So in that Western corner, life was always different. Always, from the minute it started in 1945 up until the point it ended, we were always the privileged ones.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Balan, I really appreciate you sharing your story with me tonight. That's been really interesting and really insightful.
My pleasure.
I do hope you enjoyed Balint's story. We have further photos and information in our show notes, which are at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 85. This will also show as a link in some podcast apps. Don't forget, if you'd like to get that Cold War Conversations coaster and keep us on the air, head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate, or again, click on the link in your podcast app. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where our guests and listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.